Part 2. Introduction. In Part 2, we will look very briefly at each of the figures on the refuge tree of the Triratna Buddhist Order. Each has their own story to tell. Some, such as the five jinnas and the bodhisattvas, are clearly archetypal. Others, such as the teachers of the present, are clearly historical. In between come a number of figures who straddle the realms of myth and history. Padmasambhava and Milarepa, for example, left no writings, at least not in the ordinary historical sense. And what mythical biographies we have post-date them by many centuries. So how should we view the following stories? In the West, we're used to discriminating between myth and history. History, we tend to think, presents us with the real truth. Myths, if not dismissed as mere myths, are often taken as diverting stories that cast some light on the way people used to think. In reality, myths have the capacity to contain far more truth than history. They can touch depths of experience that are beyond the scope of mere historical fact. History tells us that Padmasambhava may have come from the Swat Valley in what is now Pakistan. Myth tells us that he converted the demons of Tibet to the Dharma by discovering their secret names. The historical fact is interesting, but the myth communicates an immensely valuable psychological truth, that if we want to deal with the unconscious forces that trouble us, we must first uncover their names and natures. Only then can we harness the energies tied up in them and transform them into a force for the good. The distinction between myth and history is very much a modern phenomenon. I was fascinated to read Xuanzang's account of Nalanda Monastery, and I quote some of this in the relevant section. For Xuanzang, myth and history are completely indistinguishable. Avalokiteshvara walked about at Nalanda, as did the Buddha, and as did Xuanzang's immediate monastic forebears. All are given an equal historical status. In producing this account, I have not made very much of the distinction between myth and history. What we have here are stories, some almost entirely mythic, some largely historical, some a mixture of the two. Sometimes I have drawn on modern scholastic knowledge, sometimes not. My approach has been multifaceted, and at this point in history, perhaps it cannot but be. When looking at the figures on the refuge tree, we need to learn to shift perspective, to look at them now from a mythic, now from a scientific historical, now from a devotional, now from a human perspective. Approaching the tree from these different perspectives, it becomes increasingly three or more dimensional. If we're not careful, these different perspectives can cancel one another out. History is more true than myth. Myth is diminished by mere history. But used with awareness, all these different perspectives can enrich our appreciation of the majestic figures on the tree, imbuing them with more life and more meaning. In short, we need to approach the figures on the tree in a spirit of open-mindedness. In that way, we can allow them to speak to us as they will. On this same note, although I have, for example, in the accounts of the lives of the Arhants, based my accounts on canonical records, I've not always confined myself to quotations from the canon to tell the story. Sometimes I have created dialogues where none appears in the suttas. I have done this because I want to tell a story, to help bring the figures more alive, and because in any event I'm aware that the suttas themselves are also stories, in the sense that none can be taken to be a historically accurate factual account. Some people, when they heard I was writing a book on this refuge tree, told me how much they were looking forward to its publication. This was in part because they really looked forward to finding out why Sangharakshita had chosen these particular figures. Out of all the vast panoply of Buddhist saints and teachers, why these? What do they mean to us in the Triratna Buddhist community? And for what teachings ought we to look to them? I'm afraid I shall perhaps disappoint some of my readers, for there is no single answer to this question, and I've not sought to address it. The refuge tree is, above all else, a symbol. As such, its meaning can only be apprehended in the symbol itself. Any attempt to explain the symbol reduces it to a lower level. In trying to explain a symbol, we often only explain it away. The refuge tree, of course, is not only a visual symbol. Each of its figures has a story, and these stories are also symbols. What we need to do is fully immerse ourselves in their teachings, histories, myths, and legends, and reflect on them. In doing so, we will gradually discover what each of them means to us individually. In that way, we allow them to stand as living symbols. I have been able to provide only the briefest introduction to each figure. I've not attempted to give a connected account. There are too many of them, from so many different dimensions, and we know such varying amounts about each of them. Nor have I laid out the different sections in accordance with the pattern in which we normally build up our visualization of the tree. For the purposes of exposition, it made more sense to arrange this part of the book rather differently. Each of the accounts that follows can be, perhaps ought to be, read independently. There is an enormous amount of information here, too much perhaps to be taken in at one sitting. I have tried to point out a number of approaches, and I hope that readers will, in their own time and in their own way, follow up some of these introductions for themselves, getting to know some of these towering figures in much greater depth. Any one of them would reward a lifetime of study and contemplation. I hope that for some of you, a great journey of adventure and spiritual discovery will start right here. End of introduction.